Judges chapter 15, Samson's War. The entire time you go through the life of Samson, you get the feeling that devotion was secondary with him. And I think a lot of Christians can fall into a similar trap where music becomes primary, the word becomes secondary, prayer becomes primary, the word becomes secondary. That flips everything upside down. But that's how his life was, upside down. He's so perplexing. Well, not really. On one hand, you understand it very easily because he's so selfish. He's so self-centered. It's all about him. On the other hand, of course, he's got all of the evidences of God in his life and shows no appreciation for it. The Bible is a book of men and women with all their faults, and it doesn't give them to us always as model sinners saved by grace, nice little boys and nice little girls. It is filled with those who make great blunders, with imperfections, just like ourselves. That's why we can identify with them. That's why we're eager to receive lessons from the scriptures, because we can. And as I look at the life of Samson, I wouldn't protest his presence at the Lord's table in heaven. I don't think he'd protest any of ours either. I do not want to be the elder brother of the prodigal. You see, with the elder brother, the prodigal brother didn't meet his standard. Why does he get? Simply because he turns back to you, Dad, simply because he repents, he's restored, and he is celebrated. Yeah, that's exactly why. I don't want to be like that, looking at the lives of these characters in Scripture who ultimately are listed amongst the heroes of faith. In verse 1, after a while in the time of wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. And he said, "Let me go into my wife, into her room." But her father would not permit him to go in. Just reading this, it sounds a little comical. It says it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat, like the two of them were going to visit. But the goat was going to be a meal. After a while, in the time of wheat harvest. Now, if you remember, in the last chapter, Samson had the marriage ceremony with the Philistine guest. But the Philistines had gotten to his wife, and under duress, or I'll put it this way, they threatened her. If she didn't tell the secret of his riddle, they'd burn her house down with her father and her in it, and all the rest of the family. And so she, of course, tried to get the answer to the riddle that Samson gave at the festival. And she did get the answer, and she told them, and Samson figured it out, and he was so angry. He went on a killing spree. And then he stomped off home without consummating the marriage. Well, some time has passed, probably 8 months to a year even. We don't know for sure. And now he wants to go and consummate the marriage with his wife, to consummate the betrothal. It is the time of wheat harvest. That means it's May or early June. The different elevations in Israel bring in the crops at a different rate of speed. It's Pentecost season, a feast of weeks where the Jews would celebrate the wheat harvest. It happened that Samson, it says here, visited his wife with a young goat. This was a peace token. Couldn't find a bouquet and box of chocolate, so you bring a goat. And perhaps he learned since that she had to get the answer to the riddle to save her father's house. Throughout the life of Samson, we can tell he has no care. He holds the Philistine men in contempt, but he is attracted to the Philistine women, and that brought all these problems in his life. Why didn't he stay in his territory and do war with the Philistines instead of trying to mix the two together? And it shows up in his ministry as a judge of Israel. But likely he did learn, and now he's coming back to resolve the matter and the matter of loyalty. You would hope that he gets to the bottom of that with her. I know, I heard. Or is he just lonely? It does appear that none of the Jewish women had any interest in him. They never show up in the story, except his mom. Pretty bad when your mom's the only female that likes you. Anyway, and he said, "Let me go into my wife, into her room." Of course, in his head, she belonged to him, and he wasn't alone. It was law, and the others would do, even the Philistines believed that. But her father would not permit him to go in. That's an awkward moment, and being that it's Samson, it's a very dangerous, it's a volatile moment. You never know with this guy in the Philistines. Verse 2, her father said, "I really thought you thoroughly hated her. Therefore, I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she? Please take her instead." Well, her father really thought this. A note would have been nice. You know, postcard, "Hey, Samson, he coming back?" Hated, he says, "I thought you hated her." "Yeah, because she betrayed me." Well, you know, and we probably figured that out by now. But legally, he's married. The betrothal was in force. It's typical of Samson that she should just wait indefinitely for him to get over his temper tantrum and come back, though. So you know, he's not blameless in all of this, how he handles it, but still, this is his wife. "Is not her younger sister better than she? Please take her instead." What kind of parent is this? I'm, of course, like Laban, you know, but is that any way for a parent to speak of a child? "Well, you know, she's kind of ugly anyway, and the other one's better." This was crazy to do this to a child, to pit one against the other or show one as being above the other. What a recipe for ruin, just in pain and suffering, so unnecessary. But these were immoral people. No one would like to be treated this way. Why would you treat another that way? These are the questions that the New Testament starts holding us accountable to, getting to the bottom of and not letting us wiggle away from. And they were commanded to be evicted from the land, which the Jews did not do. Joshua and Caleb's generation, you know, they subdued the land and they left it to the future generations. They said, "Now we've laid this foundation, go finish the job." Well, they did not finish the job and they are reaping the consequences. We'll return to that. But beginning the work in earnest was not enough. Verse 3, as a nation, getting rid of the Philistines and the other Canaanites. And Samson said to them, verse 3, "This time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them." Well, this is a threat. And he justifies his possible destructive actions because, "Well, you cheated me. Now I declare war on your nation." Personal reasons. It's not, "Well, you know, God is, I'm just remembered. You know, I've been a little negligent. We've been commanded to get you people out of the land. I think we need to ramp that up again." No, he does not do that. This is personal. "You hurt my feelings. You've stolen my wife. You had no right to do that, so I'm going to hurt you, and you won't be able to blame me." What kind of, like a 5-year-old. "You can't blame me." What does blame have to do with it? And you're killing people. I mean, blame has something to do with it, of course, he's guilty of it, but the way he is saying it is that I'm justified in doing you harm. Never mind that the people that he's intending to harm, as people go, did nothing wrong to him. If anybody should have been punished, it would have been the father-in-law. He had no right to give his daughter away, and he took Samson's, you know, betrothal money. And then he gets another hit from the substitute husband. And when we get to verse 6, we'll see that everybody will say, you know, Samson did this because his wife was given away. So Samson decides to take out his anger on the Philistines, and he does it in a very radical, very serious way, and it just brought nothing but bloodshed. He's going to literally burn up their fields and their groves, their vineyards. He's going to damage their economy severely, blaming them again for taking away his wife. But his motives, nothing to do with God. So unlike David, so unlike Caleb and Joshua. He's content to live with the Philistines so long as they don't cheat him. Once they cheat him, he's provoked, and he feels now that he can strike back. A petty person is what he is, and there are petty people like this. They just won't let it go if you've hurt their feelings in any way. New Testament, we find Paul dealing with this all, and suffer the loss, Paul says. What is this, taking Christian to court in front of the unbelievers and bringing all, airing all the laundry in front of everybody without shame? Come on, stop doing this. And so we have the precepts, the letters of the apostles and those under their authority. Samson was a spoiled rich kid. Now, that does not mean all rich kids are spoiled. I've met a good amount of them, and they're not all spoiled. Some of them are very noble. And you can find spoiled poor kids, which is kind of worse because you can't borrow anything from them. So, just David, King David, to hold the motives next to each other when he faced Goliath. Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin." That's a lot of gear to take out a shepherd boy. Aren't you a little overkill there, Goliath? He says David to Goliath, "But I come to you in the name of Yahweh of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." You got to love it. God was center for everything David did. Even when he was sinning, he knew it was wrong, and it was just way wrong. But God was always in David's thoughts. Samson, you just can't make that case for him. How would you like to be his lawyer getting him into heaven? Well, he is a believer. And the evidence is? Hebrews 11. That would be probably all you've got. Well, now, we're not reading the whole life of Samson. We're just getting the highlights, and they're brutal. Not in his favor. Verse 4, "Then Samson went and caught 300 foxes, and he took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, and put a torch between each pair of their tails." Well, so, of course, how much time does it... Now, these are jackals, not likely foxes at all. I'll get back to that in a moment. But he's thought this out. He has been stewing and brewing. How much time does it take to set bait and traps and empty them and keep them alive till you get up to your 300 quota? I mean, in his head, he is like, boy, wait till they get a dose of this. He is steaming. The scorn that's burning in his heart. And those torches have no heat next to his heart, the scorn that's in there. Samson's war. And it will cause the Philistines to understand that Samson is the bringer of death. When he shows up, Philistines will die. It's a nice point in the story, though, that there are no recorded Jewish deaths in the judgeship, under the judgeship of Samson. Doesn't mean they did not occur, but they're not mentioned, and that is significant to his judgeship. But the passion to get even, it seemed to come so easily to Samson. It's just no problem, no second thought. No, now you're going to pay. It's like the guy you just do not want to wrong. You know, you give him 90 cents to change for a dollar, and you give him accidentally, you leave out a dime. He's going to come kill everybody. Well, these animals, in the Hebrew, the fox and the jackal have the same name. And how you distinguish them, I guess, is from the context. And here's a good lesson on scriptural context, because foxes, they're not abundant in that region, not as jackals were. And so that is, of course, one of the answers, foxes being solitary animals. I mean, it'd be a lot more work to get foxes than to get jackals that travel in packs. And again, large numbers of them were in the land, so it just makes perfect sense. And he has to get 300 of them to get his 150 pair of jackals to turn loose on the fields and groves. Now, where did he get the number 300? It'd be nice if I knew the answer. You would be very impressed with that Bible teaching. Boy, he knew that one. I don't know how. He probably, drew straws or something. But anyway, he felt 300 was what the job called for. You could imagine him outbidding the out working out. Let's see. I've got how many acres here? That would be 300 jackals of today. This is kind of funny if you look at it that way. But it was nothing funny about it at the time. This is going to be agricultural arson. Verse 5. Thoughts going through my head. When he set the torches on fire, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and burned up both shocks and standing grain, as well as the vineyards and olive groves. So maybe you're wondering, in the process of this devastating effect on their economy, is what happened to the foxes? Did they get their jackals? Did they burn up? Well, the cord that would attach to the flaming part would likely burn up before it reached to their tails, and then they'd eventually be free. Why not just send one at a time? Well, because they would have just ran off to their den somewhere, and then that would have been the end of it. But to have them together, yoked together like this, was actually pretty smart. It's like he tried this before. It's like you see him first. All right, if I do any harm to you, it's your fault. Then he tries with one jackal, and the jackal goes the wrong way. Back to the drawing board. And when he's doing two, he's probably saying to himself, Samson, you're a genius, super genius. The little wild E coyote in this coyote man. Anyway, the killing fields are going to begin now. This would be, stealing all, breaking all that. It breaks their economy or does major damage to it. Targeting their food supply, the wheat, the grapes, the olives. And the olives had multiple, they were a multi-purpose product. I mean, not only did you eat the olives and make all sorts of nice dishes with them, but use the oil for lamps and for lotion and heating. Lamps. And you just had a lot of purposes. The shocks here are the piles of sheaves that were cut and stood on edge and ready for them to just come pick up and start working, preparing, and yet he burns them up. So this really got them. What was he expecting them to do? I think he's provoking them. He knows, I'm going to pick a fight. I'm going to declare war on them. Verse 6, then the Philistines said, who has done this? And they answered, Samson, son-in-law of the Timonite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion. So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. Well, again, they weren't going to stand around doing nothing while their food and fortunes went up in flames. And we can hear them say, who brought this on us? Oh, that, Timonite, he brought this Hebrew into the mix. He's the problem. And that's why they go to him. This reminds us of Genesis 39 with Potiphar, the wife or the master of Joseph, his wife, who Joseph refused when she squeals on him, which is a frame-up. She said to the others, see, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. And so she brings out he's, a Jew. She gets racist with the whole thing. Well, you can bet some of that was going on there. Who brought this Hebrew into town to do this? And well, they go to the house of Samson's wife's father. And, of course, what they do is not only unjust, it is inhumane. It is cruel. Their deaths were painful and senseless. It was just horrible. In the long run, she tried to save her house from being burned by these people, and it gets burned down anyway. Her betrayal of Samson did not bring her safety. It it cost her and her family their lives. And so as we look at that, we say, well, you know, these are the people that Samson is dealing with. We know that, and he is beginning to deliver his people. This would have gotten worse in time had God not raised up deliverers. In verse 7 it says, Samson said to them, "Since you would do a thing like this, I will surely take revenge on you, and after that I will cease." Well, the cycle of evil is started, and he thinks that he's going to end it, but it's not going to end this horrible cycle that he has put into motion. Incidentally, again in verse 6, it says, "Because he has taken his wife," and that's the point I wanted to make earlier. Everybody understood that this was indeed his wife, and had the father had no right to give her away. But that does not justify Samson's other behaviors and how quickly the flesh wants to justify its wrongs. In verse 7, where it says, "Who would do such an inhumane thing like this?" He's religiously adolescent, Samson is. He doesn't grow up, at least not in this chapter. Maybe by the end of the chapter, there's a hint that he improves some. But it's naive of him to think that he can just dictate the terms. "I'm going to punish you for what you did, and then we'll be even." And they're going to say, okay, that's just very foolish. Verse 8, "And he attacked them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. Then he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Etam." So he goes and slaughters a bunch of them. We're not told how many. And then he goes home. This is what he does. He's somewhat of a bully. The causes of the Lord are not his causes. It's Samson's image or whatever is hard, whatever. And so where it says he attacks them hip and thigh, in other words, he wasn't fooling around. And by telling us it was a great slaughter, we know that this was severe. We don't even know if he used a weapon or if he just, you know, one punch kind of death blow on anybody that was hit by him or even grazed. So the Hebrew for the phrase hip and thigh is he struck them thigh upon loin. So just with much strength. Verse 9, loin, pardon me. Verse 9, "And now the Philistines went up and camped in Judah and deployed themselves against Lehi." That's not a high school, incidentally. Reckless Samson, a personal feud again. It's escalating, and now it's going to be internation or international, we would say. It's an internation emergency. It's an emergency on the Philistine side. They have to respond to this, and it's an emergency on Israel's side because the Philistines, they have the weapons and the armies, and they can come and do a lot of damage. And so the tribal leaders are very much on the Jewish side concerned about this. Verse 10, "And the men of Judah said, 'Why have you come up against us?' So they answered, 'We have come to arrest Samson, to do to him as he has done to us.'" Now what's left out are the details, of course, and we're kind of glad about that because the Bible, the historians are notorious for repeating the whole story again. But, you know, he burned up our produce and he's killed people and we've come to get him. Who can blame them? God warned the Jews that if you do not drive these people out, they're going to be a problem. Numbers 33, verse 55. And how many times does he have to say it? Just once. "If you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall be that those whom you let remain shall be irritants in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall harass you in the land where you dwell." And this is being fulfilled, not only here, but it is being fulfilled here. Verse 11, "Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, 'Do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? What is this you have done to us?' And he said to them, 'As they did to me, so I have done to them.'" What a little baby. It's tit for tat there. They started it, and he's a grown man. Well, this is only one time, the only time under Samson's judgeship that we read of the Jews mustering an army, putting an army on the field. And that's kind of sad. And it's not against the Philistines. It's against Samson. They get, you know what, he's a problem. And we better send 1, 2, 3,000. 3,000 men should do. By the time he's finished killing 2,500, he'll be exhausted. And the other 5,500 can just throw a net over him. I don't know what they would think. They had to be thinking that way. When they saw the Philistines show up with 1,000 men, they said, that's not going to work. All right. So, you know, you have to ask the question, if they mustered an army like this quickly, 3,000 men, was it that Samson was just too difficult to work with, to bother mustering an army to get in back of him? Were his leadership skills so awful that no one would follow him? Well, you get that impression. You get the impression, I work alone kind of a thing, but also that good, because we can't work with you. And that would be a tragedy. Or was it that the people were so incompetent and spineless and so given into being, you know, ruled over by the Philistines that Samson said, I can't work with these people. I'd rather not have them on my side than have them. I can do better without them. Either way, for all of Israel, it's a lost opportunity to have this advantage. The Philistines knew how to use Goliath. Well, it didn't work in the end. But they had Samson. That would have been the match of the century, right? Samson versus Goliath. One, bing, boom, that would have been it. But anyway, that's how it went with David. So, he could have benefited from these 3,000 troops if he were a leader to lead them into action against the Philistines and teach them a lesson, and that would have ended the rule. But the story does not come out that way. And the Jews feel like, well, we're sparing ourselves because these people are going to come in and kill us. So we'd rather hand over Samson. It's expedient for the nation that one suffer. That's the words of Caiaphas that said over Christ. Of course, he prophesied, we're told, that year, even though he did not know it. But instead of seeing Samson as a deliverer, as they should have, they considered him a troublemaker. He rocked the boat. You just can't let sleeping dogs lie. We're doing all right. Yeah, we have to eat barley more than we get to eat wheat because of the Philistines, but that's okay. You develop, your palate begins to, you know, enjoy it after a while. Put a little olive in there. I don't know. Such an enigma. Was he really? That's part of the enigma. Is he difficult to understand or is he very easy to understand? Is it just simply, he's just selfish? Is that the answer to everything he does wrong? Or is it more complex than that? And he said to Samson, do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? What would Joshua and Caleb say about that? The church is also today, is there a church that's just too awful to attend? Sure there are. Of course, somebody attends them nonetheless, or they wouldn't be in existence. But you have to ask, as an individual, am I too troublesome to work with? You know, there are people that just can't work in a ministry because they can't work without, they refuse to work with others. Fortunately, we don't see a lot of that. But you do see it from time to time. You know, someone says, well, we do it this way, and they don't want to do it that way. And they make a mess, and then someone says, you know, can you not do it that way because this way? And they get all offended. We would have been better off if they just didn't show up then. So it's nice when you have people that just go, okay, that's how you want to do it. I can do that. You're not asking me to, you know, do something too difficult. You have to look at some of that in the story of Samson. Why is this Samson's war? Why aren't the people in this too? And I think those are some of the factors. Well, it says that here in verse 11 at the bottom, and they did to me as they did to me, so I have done to them. That's his motto. That was the cycle of vengeance that he introduced into the land. His eye for an eye approach. Well, that's what you get. You know, if you're familiar with Fiddler on the Roof, or Retevia says, when someone says an eye for eye, he says, you know, by that, we'll all be blind and toothless. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And he's right. The law was not given, that motto of the law, that rule of law was given to the leaders to understand that they had to exercise just decisions and not play favorites. And it was never intended to be permission for individual vendettas. You did me wrong, now I'm going to do you wrong. Well, verse 12. But they said to him, "We have come down to arrest you, that we may deliver you into the hand of the Philistines." Then Samson said to them, "Swear to me that you will not kill me yourselves." Well, speaking about these men from Judah that have come to arrest them, you think of Peter. At least Peter drew his sword and swung it. He didn't just say, "Oh, well, they're here to arrest you." I mean, Peter, you got to love him. You just not attack him too much. You know, before you touch my Lord, I'm going to chop your head off, was his approach. And Christ essentially says, "I really don't need this kind of help." Christ had legions, and he didn't even need them. He could have just willed them out of existence or whatever. He could have turned them all into lemmings right there on the spot. Just been hundreds of lemmings running around. All right, that's a little bit much. But back to where we are. Later on when I'm driving home, I'll be thinking about, you know, I just shouldn't have said that one. It just the lemming thing was just kind of a lemon. So they reason that it's better for Samson to go to war or to jail than for them to go to war. Maybe they were right. It says, "Then Samson said to them, 'Swear to me that you will not kill me.'" This was actually kind of noble of Samson. He didn't have to go with these guys. As strong as he was, he probably could have outran all of them very easily. But he likely makes this request because he does not want to kill any of his own people. Because he's saying, "I'm not going into anybody's hands. Nobody's going to kill Samson today, Philistine or not." And so he says, "Listen, if you're going to try to kill me, I'm going to hurt you." I mean, he's not saying that, but that's probably what is happening here. Because by going to the Philistines, he's got to believe they're going to kill him. So what would be the purpose? If he knew he was going to his death, then he should have said, "Well, I'd rather be die at the hands of my own countrymen than give the enemy the satisfaction of killing me." And so in this connection, again, no record of any of the Jews dying or of Samson doing any violence to his own people. But in this connection, the great possibility of Samson flashes out. What he could have been. We know that he's a very intelligent man. He makes riddles. He renames places. And I think that the men of Judah missed it. The men of Judah did not say, "You know what? He is a noble man. He could have resisted all of this." He just says, "You guys going to hurt me?" And, "No, we're not going to hurt you." But they miss it. They're just so, their eyes are on the Philistines. Nobody's looking up in this picture. So they spoke to him saying, "No," verse 13, "but we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hand, but we will surely not kill you. And they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock." Well, Samson thinks this is humorous. That comes out with Delilah. "Well, if I'm bound with new ropes, I can't break them." Well, when he already did, they say he's going to taunt her with that. But what does he say at this point? "Thanks for not killing me and handing me over to killers." He has no intention of going with these men. He's going to pull them away from his people a little bit, but not out of sight of the fight that's about to take place. Word evidently spread throughout the land of the Philistines and the Jews that Samson was invincible. And so nobody thought, though, that these new, old ropes would have been, you know, not as strong as the new ones, was the thinking. I mean, I wonder how that all worked. Was there a hardware store on the way? Did someone say, "Better bring the new ropes with you"? It's always a cute little question, but verse 14. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. Then the Spirit of Yahweh came mightily upon him, and the ropes that were on his arms became like flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds broke loose from their hands. Lehi, incidentally, means the jaw. Kind of worked out that way. Maybe it was named after these events when the historian pens the story, because he lost the original name. The Philistines came shouting at him. Big mistake. They just should have just, I don't know, taken him into the land and then let him go. The men that are coming at him, you get the feeling they're very angry. They're shouting. Because Samson has probably killed many of their friends and family members, and they hate him. And so this 1,000 men, that's an infantry battalion against one individual. So he's got 1 in 1,000 chance. But of course, with God, those statistics don't count. Then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. Strength outside of his own, supernatural strength to burst, to take these ropes and just to, you know, just like pull them off like that. I mean, you couldn't even do it easily with yarn, let alone ropes. It's just so many questions, you know, the comical questions I have about these stories. I would like to, okay, let's try it now with, quarter-inch steel cable. Okay, you got that one now. Verse 15, he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand and took it and killed 1,000 men with it, just like that. Fresh jawbone, meaning not brittle, perhaps the work of scavengers. Jackals would be good for the story, we don't know, but somehow there was a donkey that died not too long ago in that vicinity. And the old jawbone would have been too brittle, and so he finds a fresh one. Years ago, when I was in the military in Greece on the beach waiting to be picked up and taken back to ship, where the food was really good, there on the beach is this jawbone next to me with the teeth still in it. It wasn't fresh, but the teeth were still in it. And I presume it was a donkey's. It was long enough. Now, I had the jawbone, but I also had a .45 on my hip, so I wasn't too worried about the Philistines. So he reached. Well, I think of that when I read the story. I remember I even took some of the teeth home. I have since lost them. I don't know. They didn't fit. But they were huge, and it was too small to be a horse, and had to be a donkey. And I wasn't a believer then, but when I became a believer and read the story, of course, it connected the dots, and I feel very special being able to share that with you. Just thank you for not yawning. Reached out his hand and took it. He's a bit of a wild man. He can weaponize anything. He's like, I need something. He sees these 1,000 guys coming at him. He says, fisticuffs is not the answer. I need an advantage. And there just so happened to be this jawbone. And so instinctively, he goes beast mode on everyone and killed 1,000 men with it. No other battlefield in the world like this one. The spectators, the Jewish spectators, who could probably see this all taking place. Why didn't they rally to his side? First off, the Philistines and the Jews alike are anticipating his death at any moment, and it never comes. They're just like, he's got to go. There's no way. Ooh. Oh, man. This is getting in. They're like, we're into this like 15 minutes, and still they can't make a. He's not even coming near the guy. So it's more than strength. Again, there's eye-hand coordination, there's speed. I mean, this is a phenomenal thing. When we get to heaven, if there's a video section with documentaries on these things, this is going to be one of the first ones on the list. Not at the top, but it's going to be in there. I'd like to make a. That would be a good series to teach. Things I'd like to see. David dropping Goliath, the three men in the furnace, Daniel in the lion's den. Could you look at the face of those stupid lions? Like, we eat everybody. How come we can't? I don't get it. just so much funny things. I mean, the fish going through the Red Sea with Moses. Were there fish like looking at the turtles in there, looking out? Questions, questions, questions. So many questions. The Bible is an exciting book. Yet God says, yeah, read it and enjoy it. And then go live it. And it's, okay. Anyway, the spectators, they saw this. They were anticipating the death of their champion, and it does not come. Did the men of Judah feel an urge to join him? Were there anyone in their ranks saying, you know, we just can't stand here? But that's what they did. Verse 16, then Samson said, after he kills them, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men. He slays the Philistines with the jawbone of this donkey. And then it's pun time. It's time for him to wax eloquently, to shine out with his poetry in the name of his homely, you know, weapon, this jawbone of a donkey. His triumphant words. It's a play on the Hebrew language. It's kind of interesting. The words for donkey, the word for donkey in the Hebrew is hamor, and the word for heap is homer. So it's very close to each other. And so it's sort of like, I slew a slew of them. You know, I mean, that's not close to what he said, but that's the nature of the pun that he uses. And you'd think he would be too tired at this point to come up with poetry. Even when I'm fresh, I don't come up with poetry. Well, he's also parched, but he gets this poetry out, and it's quite remarkable. He's a well-educated man, and he comes up with these things. You know, out of the eater came something sweet. I mean, he just sees, he's creative like this. He sees humor and irony in everything, and the irony of this. And how humiliating. He wiped out your army with what? A jawbone of a donkey? And the old King James even makes it more embarrassing for them. Well, Judah watched and Judah listened and Judah even wrote down the poem. But they did not join the fight and they don't even appear to pat him on the back. Verse 17, and so it was. Let me pause before I read. The reason why one of the few reasons why I believe that Judah's watching is because of how the narrative is given to us. It says he found a fresh jawbone, reached out his hand, verse 15, and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. In verse 16, then Samson said with the jawbone of the donkey. Then he makes this speech, and he's probably crying it out aloud. And then it goes on to say in verse 17, where we are now, this is why I think they were close enough to hear and see it all. And so it was when he had finished speaking that he threw the jawbone from his hand and called the place Ramath Lehi, Jawbone Hill. That's what that means. It's, you know, so he's still at it. He slays them. He says, you know, I slew a slew of them. He's still got the jawbone in his hand, and visually they can see this. And then he throws the jawbone away and he's to Jawbone Hill. That is Samson. It was a trophy to him. Abraham would have built an altar. David would have wrote a psalm. Daniel would have knelt down and started worshiping the Lord in front of everybody. Called out to Yahweh. Samson goes poetic about what he did. And he's going to criticize God in the process. While he asks God for water. I don't know if you've ever heard the song, Yesterday When I Was Young. It's such a tragic song. I like the song. I don't want it to be about me. But I find it moving. Here's one of the parts of it. It says, I ran so fast. Would you like me to sing it? Show of hands. I ran so fast that time and youth at last ran out. I never stopped to think what life was all about. And every conversation I can now recall concerned itself with me or nothing else at all. How perfect. As it describes a professional athlete that becomes so selfish, so self-centered, that they're the star. Not just an athlete, but they're notorious for this. And I thought, you know, they played this song at Mickey Mantle's funeral. And if you know Mickey Mantle, the baseball player's life, you can see the connection because Mickey was he was actually a great boy from Oklahoma, but the fame got to him. And in the latter years, he looked back and he regretted it. But this was Samson, too. that every conversation he could recall concerned himself with himself or nothing at all. I do not want to be that way. There are those that will spin every conversation to something that is about them. Verse 18, then he became very thirsty. So he cried out to Yahweh and said, you have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised. Going from the bottom up, we can see, again, he did not want to give satisfaction to the enemy of them killing him. But he's thirsty now. Then he became very thirsty for water, but not for God. This is the first time we hear him praying. And what's it for? To satisfy a thirst for himself. Empowered by the Lord, but still the flesh was so weak. We read of God doing for Samson, but we do not read of Samson doing for God. Because God is going to give him the water. Is this a praise or a protest? Let's see it again. He became thirsty, so he cried out to the Lord and said, you have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant. Well, that's praise. And now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? So that's a protest. Exodus 14, the Jews came to Moses after they were delivered from those butchering pharaohs. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? And they were saying, so you freed us from one danger just to kill us with another. And that's not what God is looking for. The three men that were in the furnace of Nebuchadnezzar, who came out with not even the smell of smoke on them, which is just another miracle baked into it, they were very grateful for God. But they also said at the very beginning that deliverance from the furnace was not required for them to be loyal to God. It's always worth reading that in Daniel chapter 3, verse 16. O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Oh, man. I mean, you don't talk to a king like that ever in those days. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar is probably the most powerful king in all the Bible in the terms of just he was so sovereign. He could just kill him. He could do anything he wanted. The wise men didn't tell him what his dream was. He just had him wiped out. I mean, he had power over the religious people. Usually, the church, but the religious folks and the royalty, they clash, but not with Nebuchadnezzar. And they stand up to him and they said, God doesn't have to save us for us to not worship what you're all about. Wow, we Christians should be remembering that more often in our lives. Proverbs 24, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. Yeah, but in the day of adversity, it's hard. It's not always easy. So this indirect thank you at best, acknowledging what work God did through him, soon takes a step backwards. You know, a step forward, two steps backwards, and now he's suggesting that God had only done half the job in delivering him. And yet God in his mercy gives him the water. So here we have this incredible victory that nobody saw coming. And in Scripture, this is typical to have a great victory like this and then to quickly be tested in the faith. And no sooner had the Israelites come through the Red Sea than they were faced with hunger and thirst, and they began bad-mouthing Moses, as we just read. Elijah's great victory on Mount Carmel to end the drought, and then to run to the gates of the city and to beat the chariot on, and then to be chased into the wilderness at the threat of a contract being put out on his life by Jezebel. And that's a lesson for us in Scripture. To have a great victory, be careful. Don't Don't let your guards down. Verse 19. So God split the hollow place, that is Lehi, and water came out, and he drank, and his spirit returned, and he revived. And therefore he called its name Ek-Hakkari, which is in Lehi to this day. So there he is again, poetry. He's naming places all over the place, Jawbone Hill. And now he names this, Prayer Springs, where prayers are offered up and God answers. And so he's just still at it. God would have looked bad, if Samson died of thirst after he beat the Philistines. God wasn't going to let that happen. But Samson doesn't know how to even talk to the Lord, which suggests he doesn't know how to pray. Why would he not know how to pray? Because he doesn't practice. You learn how to pray better as you go on in life. I hope we do. Although I do sometimes wonder if I'm learning. I try. I talk to God enough. But I always feel very comfortable talking to God. I know that he hears everything. And I know my place before him. Samson, you read the story, and he said, do you know who you're talking to, Samson? He's not one of these thousand guys. When do we get to the part where Samson thanks God? We don't. And God ministers to his outer man. How ready God would have ministered to the inner man. I don't want to be like this. Therefore, he called the name Ek-Hakkari. Again, the spring of one calling, or prayer springs. And so the Jawbone Hill and prayer springs, two names that he pins onto the... He defines these places. These dramatic names demonstrates his creativity. Verse 20. And he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. Well, he must have had more to him than just what we've read so far for him to survive 20 years of judgeship in Israel. It does imply that he did actually lead or preside over hard decisions in the lives of the people. But he was false to his calling, and he will go back to his flesh will again rear its ugly head and dominate and lead him into self-indulgence, which will end in his untimely death. Going back to the song, Yesterday When I Was Young, there's another line in here that I think fits the life of Samson. The thousand dreams I dreamed, the splendid things I planned, I always built, alas, on weak and shifting sand. I lived by night and shunned the naked light of day, and only now I see how the years ran away. That's Samson. Spurgeon said his whole life was a series of miracles and follies. So this one man, Samson, watching the Samson's War, we look at this, we say, this is how not to live. How not to be the believer. And perhaps this victory, though, changed him a little bit. And that's why we have at the end of this chapter that he judged 20 years in the days of the Philistines, which is a remarkable accomplishment, nonetheless. Well, the next session, we get to the end of Samson. The climactic story of Samson and Delilah. Let's pray. Our Father, another night of instruction from your sacred word. We thank you for it very much. May, as always, you find us building upon these lessons, avoiding the traps and the mistakes, and taking advantage of the blessings to your glory. May he get us all home safely tonight. We ask you in Jesus' name. Amen.